Okay, now I will talk today. Us again, we're supposed to start, right?
You can start.
Yeah, right. Dark matter halos and profiles. So on the different properties of dark matter halos, I concentrate only very few issues, which is actually nevertheless very important, and it's a profiles. And the profiles will be, we'll start from different arguments. We'll look at the inner part. And afterwards, we'll go in a bit on further way. For non-astronomers, what we do. So this is how distribution of dark matter looks like if you have enough particles. And we'll see some details later on. So what we will discuss is the structure of object like that. Okay. So for that, we need to go to something else. And this is how it will look like if you start to zoom in. And I put more waves and different resolution. Okay, now this is a model for a local group. This is our Milky Way, and this is M31, and we'll see more names later on. So we'll add some galaxies. In the sense of mechanics, so to speak, it's actually quite complicated system because it has a humongous range of amongst the dynamic range, so the density changes by many orders of magnitude, and we would like to have at the end of the day something with an accuracy of about a few percent, so which is a challenge. The challenge in the different ways, it's a heavily nonlinear, but at the same time its complexity even more than you would think, and this is what we'll learn if we look at the animation of formation of that object. We yesterday we have some kind of a few kind of movies, you have a filaments and so on. So let's see how that will happen. So this is now will be the history formation of an object which is comparable by size and different properties with our Milky Way. We go back, mouse, and click on it one.
Okay, no, don't plot.
Okay. Go ahead. I will stop it at some moment, we'll come back. So we did the redshift and everything else, and the satellites coming, and then now we're looking at the structure and see how everything moves. And here's a M31, 32, 6822. We put some names on it. Yeah. No, it's okay. But the problem is that, for example, we don't see Magellanic clouds, so we still have something to do. Yeah.
Another, this is a constraint simulation.
It's constrained to some degree, constrained by mass and the configuration of a pair, but that's about it. So it has something which looks similar on large scales as our local group environment.
But do you mean constrained a la Bertzinger or constrained a la look at different halos in a big?
It's constrained
object?
Like
a la Bertzinger.
How did you color? Find the region you wanted to simulate?
Like.
Hey. Okay, forget about Bertzinger. Okay, now it's constrained by environment. Okay.
By what?
Environment is, you know, in a big box you find something which looks like us.
Looks like us.
Yes.
Okay. And in one box you just looked around until you found something like that.
Yeah, and the structure is not much different. So well, the point is okay. Let me start at the high rate shift, just to see what's happening.
Looked around.
Yes.
Okay, now at this moment, so where it shifts 6. Actually, this is what we yesterday was talking about, all this, you know. This is how progenitor of our galaxy would look like. Okay, so you already have a central object which is relatively massive. And the central part actually is in place already. The central few kiloparsec is already there and will not change much. Okay. But you see, it's accreting lots of material, and that accretion is heavily non-spherical. This is where it's most of the mass grows. This is where our central part kind of forms. It's very, 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 very nonlinear and very non-simple. It's neither nice pancake model. It's neither spherical accretion model. Later on, it will get more in a spherical accretion, but it's already too late.
So most of the mass is coming in after that. Is it coming in through the spherical boundary of your high resolution region, or is that just
okay? There's no spherical. There is no. It's like what we see, but there's actually there's more material outside. Okay, let's see now. I think we start to get the feeling, and you have all kind of possible problems already. All this substructure clearly seen there. There's a tons of that material flying around, and we're looking for the structure of that object on a different scales. Normally, that's formulated in a dramatic way as a slope in the central part of the dark matter halos, and this is what normal kind of how it's kind of highlighted when you compare that with observations. Okay, so the alpha is the central slope of the dark matter density minus one for Navarro Frankenwhite. It goes on the peripheral part when it gets steeper, of course, because the profile goes down. And observations are lumping around here. Observation is totally different story. Right? It's okay. So it's kind of dramatic difference between very the cores and the cusps.
But here you're plotting it in physical units, so you're mixing together the whole range of masses of halos, some of which have small cores.
Okay, I'm not doing that. This is a Diblock Boltzmann all kind of incarnations. So that's all permutations. Okay, so this is a recovered density profile of galaxies, dwarf galaxies, and low surface brightness galaxies.
So it's a limited mass range.
Okay, observations. Yeah, it's limited by observation. Again,
observations. What am I looking at? Have you
observation
the theory yet?
Okay, this. Okay, points observations. Okay. This is what is recovered from circle velocity from rotation velocity curves. Okay, and at different points in a galaxy, you will see the circle rotation velocity. You differentiate that, and you get to the slope of which is assigned to dark matter. And this is what your theory would kind of predict if you would be exactly on the Navarro Frankenwhite. Okay. So now that's a few years kind of story already. And on the theoretical side, there was quite a bit of an effort trying to reconcile. Okay, and there's different venues how to reconcile observations and simulations. At a face value, we have a significant problem, and actually this is the only problem which is the current cosmological model actually experienced on kind of gross scale, so to speak. Okay. The satellites is not as a big a deal. Most of the satellites which you saw in that simulation should not be bright, so they will not have any luminosity. Okay, I will only discuss that one. So mostly I'm interested in what kind of theoretical predictions we make. And recently was a few kind of venues of addressing that, or you modify the dark matter particles. Dark matter will be different nature, that kind of died out. So the more recent drive, instead of inventing particles, you try to kind of figure out what actually theoretical you predict. And there was significant effort in that direction, to some degree misleading. And as we come to that, the next point, now this is from Felix Thor compilation. Okay. Now this is, again, this is observational data points, the same what we saw. This is a standard Navarro Frankenwhite kind of a curve, which is here. And if it is steeper, we're even here. And this is the kind of a curve which they derive from simulations. Okay, now, can you see no problema, signora? There's no problema, right? And this is what they showed last year in the different conferences, and this is what produced a bit of confusion.
Sorry, SWTS,
stored white, whatever.
Okay. Okay.
But this is for satellites inside a large halo, right? Or is
no.
It
no, 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 it's progenitor.
All halos?
Well, it's not all halos. We will see the halos later on.
Are you going to tell us whether that stands as a result? Or?
Yeah, we'll just next plot. Next figure will be the stand. Again, you're free to ask questions because I have only 15 plots, so we could go through it very easily, and so stop it at any moment.
Okay, so the claim of SWTS is basically that there is no NFW.
Yes. Okay. So it's you see it's quite shallow here. If you go to that distance, it's got a bit shallow.
Well, actually, it's different than the
simulation.
What
was the reason? Resolution?
What don't you say?
We'll come to that.
You take a flat line at around beta of 1.4 or 1.3. And that fixes you where we are at the resolution-wise. It's actually all the data points.
Okay, I'm counting. Don't give up my kind of secrets. Okay.
No. Okay. Are you saying that solid line is extrapolated?
What's done here? If you read the abstract, you say the theory actually does not predict any, or there's no contradiction between theory observations. Because in the central part, the cusp gets flatter and flatter and flatter, and actually it should go too flat or flatter enough to be compatible with observations. Okay. Now let's see what actually, and it's like what's written in abstract. But let's see actually what's the kind of data they're getting. This is what Matthias was trying to jump a bit of ahead. So this is actually the data. Or their simulations, okay, and the approximation what we're telling about. So this is a four halos of different masses. This is a three more simulated with so many minimal particles, and a different curves. Okay, now let's take one like this one. So we're plotting radius in the units of R200, which is a quote unquote virial radius. It's actually not virial radius, it's over density 200, because virial radius, even for that model, is a different number. But anyway, we'll come back to that later, but in those units. Okay. So this is a simulation. Okay. This approximation, the dash, this one, that's the Moore et al. Profile, which is 99. At that time, the slope was minus 1.5 in the central part, and there was a bunch of Japanese who kind of jumped in bandwagon and say, oh, we also see 1.5. Okay, so this will be that curve. Here, the dotted curve is Navarov and Kanwhite. And the new approximation is its full line. And sometimes you cannot see it because it goes through the points. The full line is a different approximation. It has one extra parameter, and it's tuned just to fit the data, okay? But the point here, if you actually have a look at the central part, this is where you run out of resolution. At every dumb case, Navarov and Kanwhite, which means slope minus one, asymptotically minus one, is a fit to the data. It's never actually goes below, like this one actually goes above, so it's slightly steeper. And steeper here and slightly steeper there. So this is what Matthias was hinting. So what we're facing here is extrapolation outside of your data. And that's give us a kind of a different question about that all this n-body results. We actually don't know how that curve forms.
Anatoly, for the non-numerical, remember this space that when you talk about data,
simulations. Simulations of data. Yeah. You see, and it's as real as your images of galaxies. So this is what numerical observations give us, right? So this is simulations. So what's the way of doing actually was wishful thinking. We want to have it flatter. Sorry. So they extrapolate afterwards outside of a region when you actually have some results. And so everything which on the previous plot was actually pure extrapolation without no justification.
But even so, I would have thought that the data were not applying further in than the resolve part anyway, so that there must already be a discrepancy even where the last resolve point is. I mean, forget whether it extrapolates beyond there.
No, it depends how you do it. It depends how you do all this.
It's already within less than a percent of R2.
Now, if you start to actually to think about it, now the problems was on the previous plot. Okay, let's see.
Even the previous one, discrepancy is evident at any radius, essentially. Yeah.
No, this is where you start to get a problem. Okay, now if you go
to us in R over R200.
Huh?
So express that for us.
Okay, now those galaxies are normally dwarfish objects with velocities about 56 kilometers per second rotation velocities. Those will have a virial radius is about 100 kiloparsec. Those here about RVir. So again, to here we go to 100, so it's a 1%. If you formally go through that plot, you go to 1%. Your Nafarov and Kondratiev steeper. So it's all optical illusion, so to speak. So that result which produces actually quite a bit of a commotion in observational kind of side for observers, because if you look at the plot, they say there's no problem. But actually, that was a misinterpretation of numerical results.
Yeah, well, point that you don't measure R200 for galaxies. I mean, that scaling, if you say, how do you convert that to R200? Who knows?
No.
You
no, cannot do it.
Well, if you measured R max, V max.
Yeah, you fit the galaxy.
No.
Okay, now let's.
Very poorly constrained. Yeah, you can
pretty
much
you 20
and 100 kilometers.
No, yeah. The bottom line, if you take those points, take the meta profiles which you get from simulation, including those, you cannot make the fit. You can't make the fit.
So is it fair to say that they publish something without matching it to data and only claimed it would match data?
Yeah. In that respect, yes. So they did it wrong in different ways. So this is another paper where people with extensive simulations would get into central slopes in the density profiles in the central part. This is a D1, which is about 1 year old, which is a compilation again of many simulations. So here. Each curve is a dark matter halo, and we're plotting now in the different units. So now this is a radius at which circle velocity gets to maximum. So that's a relatively inner part, so to speak. So it's not virial radius here. It's a small fraction of it. Okay, and of course the whole problem for those rotation curves is about here. So there's no reason to actually go to outside. So this is density profiles, and this is you start to differentiate those, you get a slope. And what's interesting about this one, if we should be looking around, somewhere around here, this is the slopes which are comparable with those distances which you just saw before. It's about 1 kiloparsec if you scale to the size of that galaxy. So the slope will be somewhere around -1.2. That was a progress because before they were stating that at about 1% of a virial radius, the slope should be something like -1.5. So this is now start to get a bit closer to -1. The general statement, if you read the papers, that profile gets shallow if you come close to the central part. So from now on, it's only a question of extrapolation. And this is what story at all was were doing. They simply extrapolated that, and they say, okay, now this is now shallow. But if you look carefully in the plot, yes, it gets shallow, but none of the curves ever cross -1. Significant point.
How many particles per halo?
It all depends. It's a few million particles typically. In all the simulations, it will be a few million particles around. Right.
So presumably the simulation has been plotted up to the point where you can trust it.
Yes. That's
which is a 10^-2 of R max or below 10^-2.
Yeah, it depends now what kind of object you're dealing with, because the R max itself depends on the mass of a halo. So it's not expressed in a virial radius, but it's a better way because of doing that, because you don't care what's going on outer part. So it's only in a part which you care about, and that's a slightly more reasonable way of normalizing things. Now, depending on how you extrapolate it, you start to get even problems or no problems. But so far, none of those simulations are getting below -1 or shallower than -1, which would be needed if you would just naively start to extrapolate all these results to rotational curves. So now. There's another kind of misunderstanding in that area. If you look at the, especially in all results, as is stated even in abstract and so on, it's a fact of resolution. Okay, used to be that, and there was a statement by group of Benmore and Katz and so on, if you increase the resolution, your density profile gets steeper and steeper and steeper. And that appears to be again quite a bit of a misleading, because it now depends on where you're looking at and what kind of results you're getting. And this is now our results, which are probably mistyped, because I never could type the name of Petruccioni. Anyway, this is our simulation, which is Stefan did, and afterwards we compared with different effects of resolution. So that's simulation of a cluster of galaxies. This is a density profile. This is the slope, so the same way as done before, and again, this is something like 10 million particles, highest resolution. So that's done here. You show low resolution simulation, which is still 2 million particles, right? And afterwards, or 1 million particles, what's that, right?
And 1 million and 8 million.
Yeah, 1 million and 8 million particles. So those are kind of heavy simulations. And you at each radius, this is actually the data simulation. And you start to differentiate it. Now, of course, you start to differentiate. The noise is a bit kind of high, but this is a density profile run with 8 times bigger different resolution.
But since one of them is just a derivative of the other, well, this one is so smooth. Why is that so noisy? I mean, I know when we take the derivative, it gets noisier, but that noisy?
Yeah.
It's log, huh?
It's yeah, it's a log.
Wow. Okay.
No, it's not that. It's not really that bad. Okay, now let's if you start to read the numbers. This is yeah, but this is the whole point of that. Yes, you might get a bit noisy here, but the difference between those two lines, as you look at this, this is a 10% tick. Okay, so you don't see any difference between those simulations up to the last point you start to run off resolution. There's no trend with the resolution. The only trend with the resolution is how far you go. You go up here or you go up there. Okay. So now you compare the slopes. If you compare the slopes, how they behave, they all behave the same way. If you come closer and closer to the center, it gets flatter and flatter and flatter. The point is that even at the highest resolution, realistically, it never went to below minus one. So it never gets shallow. Than minus one, and this is a cluster of galaxies. So this is a whatever it is. So this is a virial radius again, depending on how you define it. And you see, there's kind of a bunch of definitions, and some of them are even misleading. But it just gives you an idea where we stand. So it's around here. That will be the virial radius. So this will be like a 1% or fraction of a percent of a virial radius. And so far, increasing resolution doesn't change the slope. It just you simply get in the different part of your curve. It doesn't look like resolution is given you took all the precautions. So you can easily screw it up if you make things wrong. But once you've done best with your code, the code now shows the same resolution at the same physical distance when you pass the resolution effects. There's no trend with the resolution, no systematics.
What are the errors?
You don't see errors here.
Well, I see there are error bars there.
Oh, you mean this ones?
Yeah.
It's how you differentiate them and all this stuff. Yeah. You can do it, and you can do it in different ways. I think this one, you just simply average those curves at different moments.
It's time.
Yeah. No, they're closely related one with another one. So you can differentiate it and see.
Because
resolution
does something, namely you can probe deeper
in. Yes, exactly. So this is the whole point. But you see, actually, the formal resolution here, for example, with a low resolution, it was slightly steeper. Which is actually, if you look at the plot, you understand why. Because that mass, instead of going here, it actually accumulates here. So it's a bit shallow here. And as a result, this one looks a little bit steeper.
So if you plot the distort curve down up there, so where is the disagreement?
It's the same. There's no disagreement.
I mean, down to lower.
All the way through. Yeah, because you look at the slope, for example, it behaves exactly the same as in that set of simulation by Diamant. So the numbers are in that respect. If you look at the same fraction of a virial radius for the same type of an object, the slope is very close to be the same for everything.
Just in below four.
It's in the extrapolation.
It's how you now start to extrapolate.
Same for the Sturet, I think.
For what?
For Sturet.
Sturet. Okay.
if you say take the data points, and you get it pretty much the same result.
Okay. So now there's also a question about how universal is the universal profile. And if you come back, for example, so if you look at, for example, at Navarro and Kinwright, it's not the best fit. You clearly see now systematical deviations, right? For example, here.
Before you get onto the fit at large radii.
How you pronounce it?
Stör.
Ah, makes sense. Okay.
Think of an H between the S and the T.
Okay. Stör. Okay. Good. Stör. Okay.
Okay. If you go back to the last to the daemon at all.
What? Yeah. Okay.
Okay. It seemed to me that the extrapolation here of the slope was much slower than the extrapolation you would have made from your data.
No, it's all it's all how you plot it. You could stretch it and you put different units and it start to get a bit confusing.
It just seems extremely flat compared to.
Yes, because it's a different scale here. Because you stretch a z axis like that.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a optical illusion. Sometimes you might get.
The translation change is logarithmic scale. Hmm? So it is logarithmic, right? So
it's what?
It is logarithmic. So by dividing out the number.
Logarithmic.
Oh, logarithmic. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So by dividing out the number, you don't stretch it. You just shift it.
No, it depends what you can stretch that axis relative to that axis.
No, but you're changing the unit. It's dividing by a number. It only shifts it. It doesn't stretch it.
We understand how we plot logarithms. Yeah, right. This is what we're getting at. Okay, now we're doing now is slightly a bit different thing. And for that, we need to kind of come back to the history of formation of each individual halo, how the halo evolves over a long period of time. This result from our paper with Pedra, but it's compatible with all other groups who are doing the same kind of a thing. This one, we end up with somewhere at redshift 2 and for dwarf galaxy. Okay, and you can learn that from, for example, how circle velocity is a function of radius. Now, this is plotted in a proper unit. So, you know, to compare the halo profiles in different moments, it's not commoving units, it's a proper unit. So we're looking for the object which is something like a 60 kilometers per second. So that's a dwarf. And this is how density profile evolves with time.
So you're taking the major progenitor at higher redshifts?
Yeah.
How do you identify?
Yeah, major progenitor of that halo, which will be at redshift 2, where we stop at the whole evolution because it's very, very high resolution simulation. And you can see, for example, now the number-wise, that's again in kiloparsecs, okay? So this is a 100 parsec, and this is a 50 parsec. And the resolution was below 10 parsec. So it's a heck of a resolution for normal kind of a dwarf galaxy. And we go to very, very high densities. Okay.
Can you say a little bit more about how you track the mass? I know we never hear that described, but it seems to me decisions that are made about...
You've seen that movie, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So could you track, and looking at that movie, could you track that major progenitor? This is what it done. Okay, nothing else more than what you see. This is a lump. You can identify it. Particles which are coming together with that major progenitor, which end up in that halo. So you can do all kind of possible tricks, and Stefan did it for tracking individual objects. But it's there. There is no much of a problem. The problem is when you track each individual lump, that will be problematic. But the whole progenitor, it's still there. It doesn't go anywhere.
Okay.
there's
no. What factor does the mass grow from z of 11.5 to z of 2.3?
Oh, heck of a distance. Yeah, this is a. Let's see. This is a. The points here. The points here. Show that
if it were an r to the minus 2 isothermal sphere, I would just say it grows in proportion to radius, so it grows by factor 10.
No, it's more than that, but something on that scale. So it grows by large factors. Yes.
And I'm surprised that you say it's so easy to track that.
It's easy to track it. Yes.
Central,
yes.
You know, 10% turning into the final 100%.
Yeah.
Okay. I still don't know how you did it.
Okay, but it's again. Look at
how many particles you have. You look for the same particles.
You take the same particles where they're going. But anyway, this is the density profile at redshift 11.5 for that dwarf. And you see how it evolves. As time goes on, it gets very quickly to the central density, which is now stays there. And afterwards, only peripheral parts start to move. And I show here only up to virial radius. Because outside, it will produce some kind of wiggles here, go down. So I'm showing I'm only up to virial radius. So that point is how virial radius moves. And you see it moves quite a lot. So this is the same. But now, what you, if you look at the evolution of density profile, once the central part settles here, it actually doesn't change. Over time, the same halo, the same central part will be there, and density doesn't change at all. This one, from redshift 5 to redshift 2, whatever it is, the central part is still the same with a very, very, very high accuracy.
So I heard that Simon White gave a talk about this, and he showed something very similar. But then he claimed, because you were just saying that, so he claimed that the actual particles are different.
Okay, particles are different.
There you go.
Yeah, particles are different. Yes.
Now that you're trying the same particles.
It's not the same particles. The physics actually is reasonable, so to speak, and understandable, because that object grows by a lot. Okay, and that grows by a lot by accreting all the satellites. Okay, so that satellite comes in and starts to orbit, and when it orbits, it does two things. It gets stripped, so its mass will be shredded, so to speak, mostly. But the central part actually moves in quite a bit inside. And that produces dynamical friction, results in dynamical friction. And the closer that satellite comes to the center, the more stripping it experiences, and dynamical friction works even more. And that's very important kind of a process, because the dynamical friction, when something sinks because of dynamical friction, which means that object loses energy. Okay, but energy in our world normally is preserved, which means that if that loses energy, somebody is gaining energy. And most of that gain of energy will be at that distance where satellites actually is experiencing the dynamical friction, which means that the dark matter particles acquire energy. So new particles are coming, and they replace the older particles. So it's a kind of a mixing in that respect.
Doesn't that seem contradictory, the fact that density doesn't change now?
Because no, it's not contradictory. Because this is how dynamical friction actually works. It actually, and it's very, very kind of important kind of factor, it's you, roughly speaking, swap the energy between particles.
You conserve the energy.
You conserve that, but you swap. You take one particle experiencing dynamical drag, right? It loses energy, but the same energy goes in the particle which is what's producing it. So it's a swapping, roughly speaking. It's not exactly like that, but it's on that level. And it's a relatively weak process. So you simply swap the particles here, so it's not the same particles which will be there. But a result of that, the density doesn't change.
Now, I would imagine the center would not evolve because those satellites would never make it to the center. Can they actually reach the center? Wouldn't they get smaller and smaller and go away at some point?
Asymptotically, it's very difficult to say what's happening. Okay, and that's in principle, they go large distance inside. And if you look at the trajectory of particles, that actually you see that. Yes, the particle which was here migrates out, another will replace it. So some debris of that satellite actually makes inside, but very small fraction, very, very small fraction, yeah. So it's a process because the dynamical friction is a very sensitive function of mass. So if you get stripped, what's left is very small fraction. because it's still experiencing dynamic friction, it gets inside, gets slipped again and again. And so this is a, who wins the whole situation. It's very difficult to say. It's very difficult to track them when then they start to lose very significant fraction of their mass. But anyways, it's very important kind of for dynamics of the whole system. It's very, very important factor. So yes, you have exchange of energy between different components, but that exchange of energy is very, very mild. It leaves that central part without actual evolution. So we talk about all this dynamical, about wild relaxation, and we'll come to that a bit later on. So dynamical relaxation actually plays very, very small role here. Now we, dynamical relaxation, wild relaxation. Wild relaxation is a formally the process of exchange of energy between particles due to collective interaction. So dynamical friction is a wild relaxation, but it's a very, very mild component because the exchange of energy is very, very big. So normally a wild relaxation is understood as the whole object pulsates somehow and you exchange the particles and energies. That will normally lead to very large exchange of energy. So the particle which will be here and experiencing wild relaxation could jump in. And normally, if you have a significant dynamic wild relaxation, you see that the density in the central part will skyrocket.
I don't know that wild relaxation only referred to heating. It refers to speeding up gravitational relaxation.
I don't know what the gravitational relaxation is. Wild relaxation.
That without violent relaxation would happen only on the two body.
Yes. Yeah. In that respect, yes.
And since it happens much faster, we call the collective effects that speed up violent relaxation.
Okay. Fine. So the dynamical friction in that respect is a fraction of wild relaxation. Okay. But altogether, it doesn't increase the density in the central part at all. And it's through dynamical friction, it's a very mild effect. It has the same time scale. It has a time scale of one dynamical crossing, roughly speaking. There's a, you go through and you basically get slipped already.
Dynamical friction is not, it's not proportional. The time scale for dynamical friction is relaxation time. It's not crossing time.
It's close to that. It's not much different. It depends how you do it. It depends how you do it.
I'm assuming here the particle that's experiencing dynamical friction is much heavier than your average particle.
No, there's no particle which experiences that. It's a satellite.
Okay, but dynamical friction purposes, it needs to have a mass that you assign to it.
Yes.
That mass is larger than the background.
But at the same time, when the satellite comes inside, it's so much stripped, so its mass goes down, and as a result, dynamical friction.
Dark.
Switches on. Yes. This is why that cumulative process is about dynamical, about crossing time, maybe a few times.
But then it's not dynamical friction.
It is dynamical friction, but it's combination dynamical friction and stripping, because you cannot disentangle one and another one. It's not a particle which moves; it's a whole bunch of them. This is a satellite which moves.
Okay, but first, what I understand from violent relaxation, the previous point is that that's the tendency to move towards the Q partition of energy, right? And then once you reach the Q partition, and there is the gravitational relaxation, on which the dynamical friction.
Okay, now that's equipartition is a local effect. In respect that you get that relaxation, that equipartition, but afterwards the particle which lost energy goes in, the particle which gets energy goes out. And now those will start to get move differently, and they're not in the same place. There is no kind of a partition or real kind of in detail, so to speak. That's normal kind of how different dynamical processes work in heavily kind of segregated potentials. So
you have a violent relaxation of stellar system. You tend to get, the system will go to the same velocity.
Yeah.
Right.
Because the partition of velocity. Kinetic energy. So, more massive stars.
Yeah, but
we have more kinetic energy than less massive.
But for okay, now
situation on dynamical time scale.
Let's see what's happened. The particle which through violent relaxation, one particle loses energy, one particle gets energy, right?
Right.
Okay. The particle which loses energy locally will have a smaller velocity than a particle which gets energy, right? But they end up just in opposite way. The particle which loses energy goes in because its force in the potential gets high velocity. The particle which gets energy moves out, and such it loses energy because it's most of the time spent outside, its velocity will be smaller.
Okay, so my question is dynamical friction the result of these effects, the particles exchanging energy and then going in, or is it just this particle filling a background and it's sort of the same energy, so there isn't room for much energy exchange, but just by relaxational effect, it creates a density gradient which slows it down, which is what relaxation is. Right, when you go through.
Anyway, let's kind of concentrate. This is how dynamical friction works. Okay, so the final result, the density profile in central part doesn't change much over once the central part forms, so to speak. You see, when you go from here to there, and now the central part totally formed, what's happened later on, you just acquire peripheral part and build the outside. Okay,
this is how. Three redshifts labeled in four curves.
Okay, this is Navarro Frank and White approximation. So then those are simulations, and this is the fit of Navarro Frank and White.
Then I have to say, looking at the curve, given that it's a log plot, that all three of your curves show an evolution of the density profile outside of, say, 0.3 or 0.2 in kiloparsecs. So your statement, you keep pointing to a larger radius range at which you say the core doesn't change.
The inner part. Okay, now inner part. This is where density. You see, this is and one tick here is a 10. Okay. Is it 10%? Okay, right.
Something like 0.2 kiloparsecs, or then.
Okay, that's fine. But you see the tendency. You clearly see the tendency. What's happened here? The density in the central part now is stay constant. Okay. Now we use that now for to construct that kind of plot. Okay, that's a simulation. It's combined simulation of the same halo. And this halo has a virial mass of 10 to the 12 solar mass. At the end, there's a blue curve here, that's redshift zero, and it has 2.5 million particles. And you go outside, and this is your formal virial radius. Okay, and this is how Navarro Frank and White approximation works. And afterwards, this part is actually the same halo, resimulated with 8 times more particles, or 10 times more particles, but it's still at redshift 9 in this moment. Okay, let's put it this way. See, the central part now, because I know how halos evolve, the central density doesn't change, and actually you clearly see that. So this part has much higher resolution than this one, because I have many more particles. It's actually just extension of the same halo. And now we extend that halo, and this is a Milky Way size halo, from virial radius, which is normally, for that object will be 250 kiloparsecs, this is where we are now, down to something below 100 parsec. And in some stage, I start to get lose interest in doing all this stuff, because, we're way below anything kind of what we compare with anything observed, right? This is kind of an exercise, because everybody is pushing and try to see how it goes inside. So this is a 10 to the minus 3 of virial radius, even smaller than that. So we get to astronomically small distances. So soon, let's see, just move it a bit here, and we'll see black hole.
But the curves that you were using to justify this extrapolation didn't have the same range of scale factor.
So what difference does it make?
Well, a factor of it's a nice hypothesis, if that's what you mean.
No, but let's see, that hypothesis, people check it many times, and they even argue that it's naively what you expect them to have. Everybody gets the same
I'm
thing.
I'm happy to make the hypothesis, but you're saying that over a scale factor of 10, that I'm supposed to believe that the core doesn't care about the growth of the halo.
Yeah.
And your simulation shows that maybe over a factor of 2 scale factor.
Okay, we'll break. Okay, Paul. So this is, and you see how it actually changes. It doesn't go anywhere, and it should not, unless you start to get in a numerical defect.
So
Okay, that's a redshift 9. Yeah. The same halo resimulated with 10 times more particles.
You said the blue curve is a redshift 0.
And the blue curve is a redshift 0.
The black
is redshift 10, or redshift 9.
And it doesn't evolve, so that's why
we
can do it. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. That's a strong assumption, which is supported by that simulation that you showed.
Yeah, somewhat claiming that it's all determined by the nonlinear physics happening there.
All simulation, look, people who done that those kind of simulations always find the same thing. The central part, the central fraction of the center of our galaxy, for example, this one, cluster, whatever it is, always will stay without change over a very long period of time. Once it's formed, it doesn't go anywhere. Okay? There's no way to it. And this is kind of a way of beating numerical effects. Because that's kind of combination. We're running that simulation forward. Even at that time, we already know what the density profile will be. Now let's have a look at the density profile. That's Navarro-Frankenwein, with a normal concentration for that type of object, 15. This is just in the middle of average over many, many, many halos profile. This is a normal concentration halo. And it extends now up to whatever it is, 100 parsec.
We have a plot of the first day.
Okay, now what it's doing after that? Yes, I have a plot of this one. So what it's doing here? It goes like that. So it's the same with so with Pedra. If you plot it at a larger distance, it goes like that and then start to dive here. This is your virial radius. And afterwards, everything else here, this is what will be built from the redshift 9 to redshift 0. That's how it's getting built.
So if you had a small mass thing at a high redshift, this means you can directly tell us whether you got a dependence on the wavelength in the power spectrum for the inner slope.
I don't have any dependence of an inner power slope on a power spectrum. It doesn't happen. There's no.
So you have an explanation as to what the Riccati...
Riccati is total... Yes, it's not right. Okay, we had much high quality simulation, and we fit actually density profile instead of what Riccati was doing, like 2 points, and you do the profile from that. Okay, so this is much high quality simulations, and we've done it many times already, and we get the same result. It's still Navarro-Frankenwein. Now going to very, very single part, and there's no effect of a flattening. Unless you have a physical effect, which nobody actually see any on those scales, which will flatten down. If you, for example, have dynamic, if you have a viral relaxation, that only will go up, because it's how a viral relaxation on those scales will do. Now we're moving outside. Okay.
Yeah. Could it be because of the difference that the people are finding is related with the way the different codes treat the embodied? Like, for example, in your code, you don't have, like, explicitly, you don't have any two-body interactions. While in the other codes, you do have them.
No, I don't think so. I don't think that because actually you take that profile and compare with other profiles in the range of radii which you overlap, you get the same answer. So it's mostly interpretation. You visual thinking what you do after that. Okay, now we're moving out. So now from the central cusp, now we somewhere around the virial radius. Now my kind of interest now is slightly different. To some degree, it's motivated by our work on Sloan when we use the satellites as a proper distribution of mass at large distances. So this one, another is the density profile, the peripheral part. You will need that, for example, for lensing when you start to do the strong lensing projection effects and things like that. So what actually going outside? You know, how far are we going? This is two plots. Of one for Milky Way object at redshift 0, and this is our simulation, which was totally kind of for a different purpose. This is a Virgo object, which actually was from constraint simulations when all long waves were set a probe accordingly. So this it does look like a Virgo type. Okay, this is cluster, and it's a galaxy-sized object. If you look at that, the different curves, now there's a density profile which is going like that. Okay, you see inner part of everything can white, and afterwards kind of goes into background. And we're looking now for this part. This is a curve actually makes, which is quite interesting, and I show the better quality later on, average over different things. This is the average radial velocity of a dark matter at a given radius. So you see zero, which means that the whole thing doesn't contract, doesn't expand, and afterwards there's the inflow part, okay, which moves in, okay. This part, this one, this velocity dispersion, it actually normally would behave something like that, okay. This one, it was caught in the moment when it was eating a group, so this is a group of objects or group of a galaxy which is there just in the peripheral part, but so normally it will be something like that. And the velocity will be something like that. So this is and this is the motivation why everybody was taking a virial radius over density 200 from numerical simulations. Why that's virial radius? Because this is exactly the point when, roughly speaking, your average radial velocity start to get to zero. This is where you allow to apply virial theorem. Okay, but this is for classes of galaxies. If you look at that kind of object, this is a 10 to the 12 solar mass object. Okay, but
hold on a second. I thought you were about to tell us from your own plot that I should take the standard definition.
I will show you.
Be multiplied by two.
I will show you now a bunch of a couple of 10 to the 14 solar mass object average and the density profile in the peripheral part. So you'll see better what's going on. But this one is interesting by itself. Okay, so in this case, this is velocity dispersion. This is circle velocity and this radial velocity. You see now, and this is its formal virial radius. You see that that zero actually extends quite a bit of a distance. And the blue curve here is actually equilibrium Jeans equation for this one. So the whole thing is remarkably is an equilibrium at a very, very large distance.
So that virial radius isn't really the virial.
Okay, now we're coming to that point. I kind of not have no luck. So people jump in the head of it, giving the whole answer in this. Yes. Okay. Now this one, but have some results to come. Okay. Now this is a kind of a tedious job because now we have lots of halos from, and in this literally had something like 100,000. From those, you select isolated object because if it's not isolated, like in previous one, you can get confused with it. You select isolated, and from those isolation, you select those halos have the same concentration, because concentration with the same mass or halos with the same mass will have a different shape because they have different concentrations. So you kind of slice now, select those which have the same concentration, and lump them together. See what's going on. Okay, and we're going from a classes of galaxies. Kind of a Virgo type or slightly more, and then we have a kind of a bit better statistics, and we're going to for groups 2 to the 13 and galaxy size a bit on the high side here, and number of objects is quite substantial, and the average over different colors here, different realizations. Okay, so now let's see this density profile in each one, and the dashed curve here is Navarro-Fencken-White profile. We're not going to the central part with those particles, but it just shows that how kind of accurately you Navarro-Fencken-White give you at least on average when you slice them in a kind of narrow range of concentrations, how accurately actually reproduce the whole data. Okay, now if you look at the clusters of galaxies, this is a average radial velocity. This is a Hubble flow, and of course has nothing to do with what's going on inside. You clearly see that you come close to virial radius, your velocity start to deviate and has that inflow pattern. And afterwards go, and at some distance start to kind of match or kind of start to approach the Hubble flow. So you clearly see that inflow pattern, and it's about virial radius.
Or
maybe
twice,
slightly small.
Twice the virial radius.
No, it actually, this is zero. Okay.
The dip, you know.
The dip is outside.
Dip is twice the virial radius.
Dip is outside. My virial radius, my infall is equal to zero.
The infall terminates at twice the virial radius, that's what I'm saying.
No, you have infall here, which means that it cannot be virial radius. Okay, so this is for cluster of galaxies. If you go to the groups, my infall here, you see two realization infall here, gets much smaller. It's all in normalized to virial radius. So the value here is 0.1 or something like that. Value here is about 0.3. So that infall pattern gets smaller. And this one is totally gone.
Okay. What redshift is this?
Zero.
Is it because of the cosmological constant?
He's already taken that into account and defined
it. Everything is cosmological constant, the same for all of them. Okay? There's no problem with that.
The reason I was saying the termination of the infall is at the base and not, you know, all through the
This is not virial radius. Virial radius is when the loss is equal to zero.
Numerical results where any discontinuity, like a shock, you will always see that spread from the base to the zero point. And that thickness is simply a kind of spreading of the discontinuity.
Okay. Whatever. But now if we look at, let's say, for example, in this one, you start to get a bit puzzled because now this point, which is I would define as a virial radius, the point when inside of which average velocity equal to zero. This is where you're allowed to apply virial theorem. You cannot do it here because you have systematic flow. Okay. So this radius is actually three virial radii. Okay. Now how that guy could possibly grow? Because if you don't have an infall, which means that it doesn't grow.
It's like an isolated halo, I think.
Isolated halo. This is also isolated halo.
No, but this is, I wrote a paper on this, the average profile of the spread around different galaxies. And if you look at the relatively low density galaxies, the only way it could be, relatively low mass galaxies, the only way it could be isolated today if it's in basically in a void.
It's not in the void.
So this is a trend that you expect.
Okay, it's not in the void.
It's in a very dense region on a much larger scale. That's why it's a cluster. In the galaxy, the region is not in a cluster. That around it, it's not in the region of mean density. It's below
it
the
is, no, no, it's actually above the mean density.
He's okay. Asking you,
okay, that's a density. That's a density.
Why isn't anything in flowing?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You see, this is the average density around that object. So way outside, it goes to average density at much bigger distance. And everything here is a positive density. Right. And this is the distance about about 10 virial radii. So it sits in a normal environment. So this is a kind of intermediate case, and you see the cluster of galaxies. Now, if it's a cluster of galaxies, you clearly see that there's a more kind of a density outside. Right. What's interesting is just have a look at the slope here and the slope of this one. This slope is about 1.8. So it's about correlation function. This one is significantly shallow. So this is about minus 1. Remember, this is Navarro-Rankine-Wide. So it ultimately goes to minus 1. So this is a shallow minus 1. So the density profile on average of our class is actually shallow. And it's about norm.
Get info, it's not enough to be above the mean density. Mean density would mean Hubble expansion. You're well below the Hubble expansion. You have actual negative velocity, you need much, much above the mean density.
Okay, then anyway, those objects, okay, fine, maybe it's obvious for you. But anyway, it's a bit less for me because how those objects actually could grow because they.
You definitely have retarded relative to Hubble expansion. It is not turned around yet. But
it's not going because it's expanding around here. Yeah.
Oh, it's slower than Hubble. You plotted for it.
True.
For
yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Anyway.
So the shells that are moving.
But anyway, let's see if you. Okay. Fine. Fine. So now the point is that in the peripheral part, that's quite important kind of a factor when once you start to consider, for example, the motion of satellites around you. Because now, who is your satellite? Who's not your satellite? To some degree, I could ignore the whole thing, you know, why do you bother? Because I know that formally taken virial radius gives me Shesson-Torman, which is mass function, which is right. Who cares what's number there? But I do care when you start to look at the motion of objects here, because those objects will know how the central part actually behaves. So their velocity dispersion will know the mass of a central object. Those are not interlopers in that respect, at a large distance away from it.
It even matters for the problem you said, who cares? Because if you put the radius at two or three times your virial radius, the mass is much bigger,
yes,
and then it will not agree with
Shackleton. It will not agree with Shackleton. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a depends how you interpret all this stuff. Anyway, so that's kind of interesting kind of a thing, because if you look at the different kind of a pattern of evolution, you clearly see the difference. There's no self similarity in that respect. The object of different mass actually don't scale reasonably. So they behave quite differently. This object, you still need to do explanation because we do know that object of this mass grow with time. So mass increases as time goes on. So how that's possible that mass increases with time, but actually you don't have a turnaround point here.
But you know, I'm thinking of the Wechsler et al. Formula for the mass increase of an object of a halo with time. And it does taper off.
But it still goes up. Anyway.
So your 10 to the 12 solar mass objects simply reached their asymptotic mass?
There's no asymptotic mass. Mass will increase slowly, but it will increase. Yeah. Now, on a cusp, okay, now I still need to move on. Let's see, there's two topics I would like to kind of briefly to mention. But you look, if we're about out of time, and we had some lovely discussion. So let me go briefly to some kind of arguments. How could we destroy the central cusp? One of argument, you have a bar, this is a barred galaxy. Okay, and it's a pretty good one, you see, there's a bar. In the barred galaxy, we have a baryonic component, which does actually wonders, because it's what formation of bar does, it channels the stellar mass from the disk to the central part. And that's done through distribution of angular momentum, mostly in the disk. The particles, or stars now, that's known as the real ones, so interact one with another one, and the stars, some stars will lose angular momentum, so they will go in the center part. Some stars will get angular momentum, they migrate out. So it's a redistribution of angular momentum in a disk, and a dark matter kind of caught in that process. It also gets some angular momentum, but relatively small. So that process, how that in that process, the cusp of a dark matter behaves. Okay, you might think about that, and was a proposition published already, that will greatly flatten down the cusp in dark matter density. You know, there's a few groups who are simulating that, it's us, Selwood and Sanasula, and there was a Dubinsky who did that. None of us actually saw any flattening of dark matter halo, but we were also puzzled because if you look at what dark matter is doing, it's actually doing very little in the sense of a cusp. And you now, if it's not flattening, it actually should do something else. Your central part gets denser, quite significantly denser. So naive argument, which we follow through all this analytics or semi-analytics, if you put that, is adiabatic contraction. So if you have a more mass in the central part, dark matter must go in. If you don't see it, something bizarre with all this stuff. So this is just an example of the simulations. The bar forms and grows and it gets bigger and it gets something shaped like that. Or you could do contours, and that's how it behaves. And in that process, you study distribution of dark matter, you study distribution of a stellar component. And this is our new results with the PEDRA. This is evolution of four models. We have plenty, but just showing just a few examples. This is only dark matter. This after evolution, after bar format, whatever it wants to do. The curves here, this initial dark matter, this mass is a function of radius. Okay, cumulative mass. This initial distribution of dark matter, and this is after formation of a bar, after a long period of time, 5 giga years or something like that. The red curve here is adiabatic contraction. And in some cases, like this one, you see adiabatic contraction is right on money. So effect was there, we just didn't plot it right. Because normally when we plot that, in that business, we plot circle velocity as a function of distance, which kind of masquerades on all these possible effects. You look at, for example, at 1 kiloparsec distance, you have an increase of a dark matter. Not much, but now there is a sum. But that's exactly what you naively expect from adiabatic contraction. Normally, adiabatic contraction, like in this case, overpredict by a factor of 2 effect of contraction. It depends on the magnitude of a contraction and some details. And there was a reason.
What is
mass of a halo. This is dark matter halo. Mass of dark matter.
So it's the mass within a given
shell. With given shell, with given within given radius, m within radius. Okay.
So sorry. Okay. How the black curve can be always above the dotted one?
No, it's not always. Or it could do whatever it wants to do.
So you're increasing mass.
No, because you have your disk also, right? You have disk. Stellar component is not shown, and it's here that stellar components go around here.
This is just a halo.
It's just a halo, yes. Okay. Yeah, it's not a total. It's dark matter. So because now you compare dark matter with dark matter, but the major component here will be baryons.
I was impressed that the adiabatic compression bit goes down when. If it goes above the inner part, it goes down the outer part.
Well, mass is preserved, believe me. Mass is preserved, trust me.
But I thought you started by talking about a bar. And here it looks as if the main effect, since you're getting agreement with the adiabatical compression, the main effect is you're taking some component of the mass and you're putting it in the middle.
Yes.
And it has nothing to do with angular momentum.
It has something to do with angular momentum. Right on money, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So it's the same story. Yes, the dark matter gets some angular momentum from the disk. But that gets some angular momentum, it's actually distributed mostly in the peripheral part. And altogether, that's a very small amount. For the disk, it's like a 10%. For the disk, it's fine. But dark matter is a big reservoir. So you dilute that angular momentum somewhere there, so you don't care much about this momentum. But most important, the inner part is a total influx of matter in the central part. So the bars don't destroy the cusp, they make the cusp steeper. And pretty much in line of adiabatic contraction. We had a recently paper with Andrei Kravtsov and Gnedin, when we actually make that correction from this curve to this curve, or just other way around. Standard adiabatic contraction overpredicts the effect by a factor of 2 in extreme cases, and it's pretty kind of along what we see in simulations. So now we're basically done. I think we're done altogether, right? Let me skip some interesting discussion here. That's how stars and baryons kind of are doing and replacement of. But let me go back, go forward. Let's go to.
Sorry, that was really interesting what you were showing.
Okay, now look, we
we can always go back.
I'm out of.
Go ahead. 10 minutes more altogether.
Okay. Now this was interesting kind of a proposition. Okay, they called hypothesis. Okay, I call it speculation. Okay. There was a paper by Gao, Loeb, Peebles, and I don't remember who else. Simon was there, and so on. This is a kind of a quotation from that paper. In the course of galaxies tend to approach through blah, 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 a universal density profile for their collisional mixture of stars and dark matter. So now, important part, stars and dark matter. Because stars will behave as collisional. There is no difference between stars and dark matter in that respect. So they say, okay, now it's a sum of a stars plus dark matter, which will be Navarro-Finkenwide, or whatever it is, universal profile. They mention Lyndon Bell introduced idea, violet relaxation may drive towards a universal structure, and Navarro-Finkenwide demonstrate behavior of that kind. That's about it, what was discussed in that paper. Okay? So that's as a normal. It has all kind of features of pseudoscience. You construct something. You don't give arguments, but that construction already a substitute for theory. So that's going on that level of a vague kind of a feeling what it should be. So that's a proposition. So if that's true, let's see what's happened. I have a stellar component. Or dark matter and stars, and the stars are forming from collapsing disk, from collapsing baryons, so it's getting the central part. So there will be more stars in the central part, fine. But altogether, that process gives you Navarro-Finkenwide. You have another collision, You build Navarro-Finkenwide all the time, but because every effect every stage will have bring more stars because the stars dominate the central part. At the end of the day, the central part will have Navarro-Fink-Invite, mostly stellar component, and the dark matter will be much below. Okay, that's one way of, roughly speaking, diluting dark matter in the central part. And this is that proposition. The problem is that proposition, from my point of view, okay, if it would be true, we're done with the cusp, at least in the cases which dominated by stellar component. Okay.
Sorry, would this apply to any galaxy?
Huh?
Would this apply to any galaxy? I mean, the Milky Way is not an F dot.
Okay.
No, this is the idea is to form elliptical galaxies.
Yes, that's for elliptical galaxies.
Only for elliptical. Yeah.
Okay, now the problem is that it's even for elliptical it doesn't work, because in the central part, it's not Navarro-Fink-Invite. The problem is that it's exactly the point. So
we know that, but yeah. We know that from gravitational lensing. If the part of the band is too profile, because most of the lensing is associated with elliptical of distant quasar, and FW is very poor at splitting images, so you will never see multiple images.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be steeper than R to the minus 1. In fact, you can only fit the statistic of lensing with isothermal profile or R to the minus 2. That's what you get from lensing.
Okay. So the point is that actually the evolution doesn't go on this way. R minus 1 is a specific kind of profile. It's very specific profile. It's kind of fragile in some sense. In the sense that your orbits are extremely elongated in the central part, because your central part is not self-bound. That's different from R minus 2. In R minus 2, projections are different, and the central part is kind of self-bound. If you take that part, you say, what's your kinetic energy, what's your potential energy? And that one is already zero, so it's already self-bound. So not true for Navarro-Fink-Invite. If you go to the cusp, it's totally unbound. So it's very, very sensitive to what's going on. Okay, this one is not. So it's very difficult to get some material in the central part, this one, unless it will be the stellar material. So what's happening this way, you actually start to build the central part, R minus 2, not R minus 1. And you bring more dark matter as according with all this adiabatic contraction. And actually, we have a simulation in the paper with Gnedin and Kravtsov. That was a cluster of galaxies simulated full scale with a feedback effects and everything else, galaxies present there. And it's exactly what's happening. The central parts get denser, and dark matter gets compressed. So instead of going down, it actually is going up. So the whole kind of idea is not more than not more than proposition, and I think that's a wrong proposition. And they somehow rely on without actually specifying the tail. Evolution of so there's no kind of a mechanism which will ultimately have the same density profile, and not that we will see that.
It is different. I mean, if you show that the inner part of the profile doesn't change, just the particles get replaced.
Yeah.
Why is the difference here? What's the difference between
they need to wipe out the whole central part, always, and recover to get the same mechanism will keep the same density profile. Once you get to R minus 2, you cannot wipe it out. That's the point.
If you keep it NFW, isn't this what you showed? If you stay at NFW, you just change which particles are inside.
But once you get to R minus 2, once it starts to collapse and go in the center, you get R minus 2, and you can't wipe out that.
Where does R to the minus 2 come from? Because you didn't show.
That's observations. No, that's observations. What they're telling you. In all galaxies, you take our galaxy, R minus 2 goes all the way from 3 kiloparsec to, I don't know, 10 parsec. You take
one.
The same old,
One.
Okay, one. Okay, fine. Okay, four. Okay, four. Okay. Anyway. Okay. So this is what real kind of galaxies will give us. If you take another kind of exercise, and we did it with Stefan. So you take Navarro-Fink-Invite halo, and you take a small fraction of the particles and take energy of them. They cool. They settle in the middle, very steep. And they have a boost in the density of dark matter just accordingly. So that's very difficult to wipe out R minus 2. So I think that was a, let me kind of go through all this stuff. Oh, no, not that. Not that. So there's kind of a lots of different kind of conclusions. And you might read it if you want, or just skip the whole thing. So there is a on dark matter halo, there is a kind of a interesting there's a lots of things yet to do. Let's put it this way. It is not clear where we stand. Once baryons start to play a role, we kind of we still at the beginning of all this discussion, but that doesn't look like a universal Navarro-Franklin white profile holds when you start to put a cooling. It does look like it's going to much steeper profiles, and those will be much stable, and very difficult to actually to go back to an FW. Okay. Yeah, but the quality of those is a bit questionable. This was when they had the bullets flying in the galaxy, right?
No. Just large and noisy simulations. And looking at the poor, it's a very small scale. I can show you.
Yehuda?
No, Julio.
Oh, Julio. Oh, I would.
It's slightly shallower than minus one, significantly shallower than minus one.
Did he have to pick it out of a large population of halo profiles?
Well, you just say it's a series of simulations. And first of all, convergence studies, there's no trend of any convergence to consistent with this what you are showing. And the curves end well below the minus one.
I haven't seen any. Any simulation which.
Yeah.
Is it the same with. Look, but there's something.
Come from, you know, from particle looking at those flows. I mean, 3SPH problem. Which, you know, you have to body relaxation at some point.
There is a paper today. All the results Caspi from body simulation
okay.
must be wrong because dark matter particles
the Chinese, yeah.
are you know a bit heavy of what they should be in reality.
Yeah.
So they claim that in body simulation because across the particle the dark matter is zero resolution mass, which is huge. Sort of behave like self-interacting dark matter because the two bodies scattering
yes.
cross-section is arbitrarily increased by the resolution. So
it's
100 GeV, you have 10 to the force of a
mass. I know, but the point is that if you, I mean, everybody knows about all this stuff, right? If you actually start to estimate the time scales, unless you then more, you end up with very long numbers. I had a special experiment. So we agreed on one. So we take and that was published on Bark paper. You know, we took a Navarro-Franklin white halo with 10^5 stars, galaxies, whatever these points, and we just simply run it. And it's cooked in equilibrium, pre-cooked in equilibrium, nothing happens. Okay, except of course you have to body scatter it. But instead of it's just simply looking how density profile evolves, which is actually doesn't at all, you do something more detailed. You take each particle and estimate its angle, and at each moment you track its angular momentum. So you say how much angular momentum of each individual dumb particle changes over a period of time. It's very difficult to do it with energies in the way how the code is constructed, but angular momentum is good kind of a statistics of two body scattering. So if you have two body scattering, angular momentum changes because you have two particles, and boom, right? So you have a redistribution of angular momentum. And we clearly see the effect of two body scattering. And not only that, it scales exactly as predicted, you know, square root of time. Okay? The time scale was 3,000 giga years. Okay. So you measure that, and we agree on that numbers with the...
But that doesn't really apply, because the first object you form will have two particles in it, and then...
Okay, now it's there's another exercise, another exercise which I did. Now that is very dependent on the code. And I agree, if you take, Tom, listen to me, trust me on that, okay? if you take 100 particles and run it for 10 billion years, and you put those 100 particles in a self-gravitating lump.
You take two particles, it's a two-body system, what do you mean?
Okay. I cannot take two because they don't feel each other. Okay, So let's continue with 100. 100 is good enough. Let's agree with that, right? So you take 100 particles, and your resolution is much smaller than interparticle separation. The whole thing evaporates because the crossing time, and this is you scale to dwarf galaxy, so crossing time is short. The whole thing evaporates. Okay, if you put it in an adaptive mesh refinement. It's constructed in a special way. There's no two bodies scattering on a small scale. Two particles never feel each other.
Because they're in the same cell, you say. In
the same. So it's constructed in such a way that you, on a small scales, on a resolution element, which is actually two cells, you're bound to have at least 20 particles. Okay. So you take 120 particles, put them in equilibrium, and run it for 10 billion years. Nothing happens. Well, maximum circular velocity decreases by 10%. 100 particles. This is a code which adapts to resolution, which is doing. So it actually doesn't disperse it. Unless you do stupid things, you put a too small resolution for the whole thing, yes, it will start to do it. Huh? Yeah, because there's two effects. One is a long-range two-body scattering, right? One is a short-scale two-body scattering, when you have collision like that. Okay, now you must eliminate that kind of collision from your code, because it's very damaging. And it happens at the very beginning when you have a couple hundred particles, 10 particles, whatever you have. And we clearly see that from when we run with the P3M, whatever it is, simulation. Two particles go away. And this is everybody is doing, you know, having that. If you're not careful about it, your small halos start to evaporate. So you need to adjust that to beat that effect. And that's done automatically in adaptive mesh refinement. So, because you're bound, by construction, you're bound to have those 20 particles sitting in the resolution element. So they cannot really dominate the body scattering. So you kill that. Of course, you have still long-range collisions, but those will be slow. You get to above a few hundred particles, that's very long time. So that's normally what kind of people who don't do that kind of stuff simply.
Ben was the only one
that Ben was the only one who is doing that.
No, but simulations where it didn't add small scale power. Where we were talking about before, where you increase the resolution but not add more small scale power. I think that's the only simulation I've seen. Actually check whether, because then it's true that the first object has many more than just two particles in it. So.
Yeah. But another way, you just increase, it's like what was done. You resimulate the same halo, you see how density profile changes, and we've done the same as it's probably you, and it doesn't change.
So I don't think it helps, because
what?
If you add extra small scale power.
Yes.
Okay, and you're simulating something different, and you still have the problem.
But it's the same halo, you see the same damn thing.
But the first object that forms still has two particles in it, or 10 in your case. Irrespective of resolution.
So, but your argument is essentially you should do a Von Dack method.
Yes.
Simulation.
Yes.
It's say, a cut of mass corresponding to, say, 10,000 particles. And then you run that simulation is higher and higher resolution.
Yeah.
No, I think I interpreted you the other way around, which was that you were saying that the universe isn't warm dark matter in these by hypothesis, and so there is never a case where you start with 10,000 particles and no substrate.
There's another effect which
you
makes
start with two particles because those are the smallest halos that then merge to make the bigger one.
Okay.
Yes, because unlike elementary particles, I mean, the dark matter, cold dark matter still has some temperature.
Yeah. Cold.
But you see, there's another way of doing that. You just change your resolution, your minimum resolution will be such that you never have too few particles in your volume of resolution. Okay, in this case, it doesn't matter what's happening. You can increase the number of particles, but you're only in that regime. And exactly what we're doing. And actually, what Ben was doing before, so you always have particles. The combination of resolution and number of particles is such that you're never dominated by two-body scattering, which everybody is trying to do. But at some level, it will show up. But that's so many giga years. And
thank you.